Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. That's the, of course, legendary Led Zeppelin, Ramble On, and the founder of Led Zeppelin, Jimmy Page, another legend, living legend, guitar legend, and his life and rock career have struck an enduring chord with fans around the globe. Page, though, has been intensely private, rarely granting interviews or speaking publicly about his life. Over the years, though, he opened up to Guitar World editor-in-chief Brad Tolinsky, who recently published his conversations with Page after first interviewing him nearly 20 years ago. Brad joins us to talk about the book, Jimmy Page, Light and Shade. Welcome, Brad.
Hey, Ann.
Let's first talk about why you wrote the book the way you did, as a series of interviews interspersed with background articles. You mentioned at the outset that one would think, given the influence of Led Zeppelin, that there would have been lots of biographies of Jimmy Page, but not at all. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, those are sort of two different questions. I basically think that the reason that there hasn't been a really great musical biography on Jimmy is because people have been so sort of obsessed with the sensational side of Led Zeppelin that they sort of forget that it's the music that really makes them important. I mean, there's a second largest selling band behind the Beatles, and that wasn't really because of their escapades, although that probably add a little bit to the glamour of the band. Really, they all four band members are really innovative musicians. And every time I think journalists would go to talk to, any of the members about the band, they would focus again on not the music, but sort of their off concert stage escapades, and then that would just turn those guys off. So they just made their decisions about the press very early on. The way I really got to Jimmy was by talking to him about the music, and then through the music, we would talk about the lifestyle and all the things that made them famous. I mean, he wasn't shy about that, but he just wanted to know that we were putting the music first. Like I say in the book, when we first met, we didn't really get on like two bustles in a hedgerow, but he enjoyed that I could, converse about the music in a relatively sophisticated way.
And you said that he wanted you to be prepared.
Yeah. I mean, doing an interview with Jimmy is a bit like going to trial. you really have to have your questioning together. You have to know the details of his work. And he really doesn't like open-ended questions either. So the more specific you get, the better it is. But on the other side of it is he gives really sort of rich, detailed answers about his music and how he approaches things.
I was struck by the detail, as you mentioned, and the richness of it, and how he could recall things from decades and decades ago, like, some kind of athlete who can remember every game he ever played.
I have to tell you an anecdote that actually isn't in the book, but just goes to prove this point, how extraordinary his memory is and how much he remembers. During one of our conversations, I casually mentioned that I did see the band play at Cobo Hall in 1973. And he, without even hesitating a second, he goes, "Well, which night, the first or the second?" And I said, I don't know. I don't remember. I said, but I do remember one thing. I do remember that you and Robert had this sort of extended back and forth where you were both playing theremins. And Jimmy goes, "Oh, that was the second night." And I suppose it did go on a little too long, because when we got off stage, Peter Grant told us to never do that again.
And he also, I thought you were going to say, well, I remember you were wearing a white outfit with a poppy on it. And he would remember what night that was that way, too.
Yeah, no, I mean, he remembers everything.
I love the story about his first guitar. It's very mystical in a way. It's intriguing.
Yeah, yeah. Jimmy grew up in sort of a suburb, his first house was in a suburb of London, and they built an airport nearby, so it became very noisy, so his parents decided to move, and when he was around 12, 13, somewhere around there. And when they moved to the new house, he went upstairs, and there wasn't anything in the house other than a guitar just sort of sitting in one of the rooms. And that was his first real guitar. It was almost as if it was gifted to him.
And his parents, they weren't wealthy people, were they?
No. I think solidly sort of lower middle class. You know, his dad was an engineer. But Jimmy does give off the air that somehow he was, that he's a man of wealth and taste, but I think he comes from humble origins.
If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Brad Tilinski. He's editor-in-chief of Guitar World magazine. He's also the author of a new book. It's called Light and Shade, Conversations with Jimmy Page. If you have a question for Brad Tilinski, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Where along your series of interviews with Jimmy Page did you decide to make a book out of it?
I always suppose especially by the time I started doing the third or fourth interview with him, I started thinking, well, I'm really amassing an interesting, body of work here. But I hadn't really, really seriously considered doing the book until about maybe 2 or 3 years ago, mostly because I got tired of seeing all these Led Zeppelin books coming out here, and the only quotes from Jimmy that they had in them were usually stolen from my interviews. So I said, oh, maybe it's time to put this thing together and have it make some sense. And that sort of traces back to your one of your first questions, which was, how I organize the information in the book. And, there are interviews and conversations with Jimmy, but I wanted it to have a lot of, information and sort of hills and valleys and some contours so it wouldn't get boring. So we did bring in a few other voices to comment on aspects either he was reluctant to talk about or maybe his recollections were a bit more sketchy.
I was interested in what you described as the origins of his reticence, and it was how Led Zeppelin was reviewed at the beginning. And it was, I had no idea until I read your book that they were horribly panned by the likes of, Cream and Rolling Stone and that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Eviscerated, I think, was one of the words you used.
Yes, absolutely. I think there were two things going on there why the critics didn't get it. Jimmy's view is that the band was already charting what music would be in the 70s, so they just didn't understand, or that the band shifted gears so many different times within the course of their music that critics given a record and then having listened to it 2 or 3 times and then having to write a review, just didn't have a chance to wrap their heads around it. But I think that there's a lot of truth to that. But I also think that what really makes Zeppelin different is that it's a sound. A lot of music critics tend to gravitate towards talking about the lyrics. And I don't think the lyrics were necessarily strong point, especially in early Zeppelin records. but it was this incredible sound that they created. John Bonham's, you know, maybe the greatest drummer in rock history. John Paul Jones, one of the great bass players, Jimmy Page, you know, mm-hmm. and his incredible vision for the production and the sound of the music. And so I think critics, especially in those times in the late 60s, who were used to analyzing the lyrics of, say, Bob Dylan or the Beatles or whatever, just didn't get it.
In reading your book, he says, my sharpest memory of working on Stairway was Robert writing the lyrics while we were hammering away at the arrangement. And that by the time they could play the song all the way through, Robert Plant had 80% of the lyrics done. In other words, he was describing that experience to show how inspired they were and how organically they worked together and channeling all the energy and so forth. But I saw that as, wow, really? The lyrics weren't written separately and very specially, and it all happened at the same time. It kind of explains a lot as far as maybe trying to read too much into the lyrics then?
Well, I don't know. You know, I mean, the subconscious can mm-hmm. produce a lot of very interesting things. You know, I don't think because he did them quickly, you can necessarily discount it. But going back to that, I mean, the band did have an incredible chemistry. And I've played in bands before and in different situations. And, you know, when you just spark off of other people in different ways, you can really create incredible things fast. But it also goes back to Jimmy before he created Led Zeppelin was one of England's top session musicians mm-hmm. for several years. And so was bassist John Paul Jones. So these guys were used to working very, very quickly in the studio, and not just quickly, but doing really, you know, good things. It was estimated at one point Jimmy was on 60% of the records that came out of Britain. So he wasn't, you know, he wasn't, I think they were used to doing that. I mean, most Zeppelin records were recorded in 2 or 3 weeks.
Right. Yeah, he worked with in the studio with the Kinks, the Who, not to mention Tom Jones.
Yeah, it's not unusual. He's playing on that song.
And then the Goldfinger, theme. That song. Yeah, the theme from Goldfinger. Who can forget that? And I won't mimic it. I'm talking with Brad Tilinski. He's editor-in-chief of Guitar World magazine, author of a new book. It's called Light and Shade, Conversations with Jimmy Page. We'll return to our conversation after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In the heat of an earlier presidential campaign, a caller to this program got an email from her CEO.
That characterized anyone that opposed the war or the president as unpatriotic and un-American, and I just didn't know what to do about it.
Bosses who tell workers how to vote, arguments on Facebook, and in the break room, I'm Neil Conan, Politics at Work. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. And it's 38 degrees with some rain throughout the day today, a high of 44. Rain mixing with snow tonight, a low of 35. Some snow expected Tuesday morning, turning into rain by the afternoon, a high of 42. Support for 89.7 comes from Ohio Northern University, hosting Discover ONU Day, Saturday, November 3rd, allowing families to learn about the blend of liberal arts and professional programs offered at ONU. Online registration and additional details are at onu.edu. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you.
sweet as the springtime of my loving.
That's a very little bit of The Rain Song by Led Zeppelin. It's a ballad of more than 7 minutes in length, considered by many to be Robert Plant's finest work, both as a singer and for his contributions to the lyrics. Still with us is Guitar World editor-in-chief Brad Tolinsky, author of a new book that pulls together a host of interviews with Led Zeppelin founder and guitarist Jimmy Page. The name of the book is Light and Shade, Conversations with Jimmy Page. Thanks again for joining us, Brad.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
And if you have any questions out there, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Michael in Delaware, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I had a question when he was putting this book together. Mm-hmm. I've read a lot of biographies in the last year coming out of that era, sort of the classic rock era, whether it was Greg Allman's autobiography, I'm reading Rod Stewart's now, I even read Keith Richards. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I get from reading all those books is it was kind of a chaotic time. They all love talked about the drugs and the women, and I know that sells books. But it seems like in hearing this interview, and I've always been a big fan of Jimmy Page's, it seems like Led Zeppelin, even though they were known for partying, it sounds like they prided themselves. They were a pretty well-oiled machine, it sounds like, correct? They had great management from the beginning. Jimmy, I mean, I'll let you pick it up from there.
Yeah. It was really interesting. I asked their publicist during, say, 73, 74, a guy named Danny Goldberg, who went on to manage the Allmans, and he managed Nirvana and a whole bunch of other things, is what from his observation, being on tour with the band, what made them special. And, you know, he went on for quite a while about their work ethic. And he said, okay, you know, they did party, they did do all these things, but when it came to the music, they were incredibly serious. And one thing that he said is, okay, so Bonham had this, John Bonham, the drummer, had this real reputation as being particularly this party animal. But at almost every show, John would show up like an hour or even 2 hours early just to tune his drums and to make sure that they were going to sound great in the auditorium. They placed the music first. And to some degree, you know, I think the exploits of all the bands during that era are somewhat exaggerated. I mean, they seemed very, very groundbreaking or extravagant at that time. But probably if you went on a tour bus with any rock band, no matter how big or small these days, you'd probably run into as much excess as Zeppelin or the Allman Brothers did in their day.
Well, and my quick follow-up for my final question is, one thing I'll also say about the three remaining members, they all seem to be in, I don't know the best way to put this, we'll use the word shape, and I mean shape physically, I mean financially, I mean they seem to be very well-grounded all these years later. I know John Bonham obviously died in a bad way, but it seems like the other three of them have really kind of gone on. There's nothing, you know, with The Who, they had to tour again because John Entwistle was in financial dire straits, and, you know, other bands, you see the casualties of the Rolling Stones, and it seems like these guys are really well put together years later. Did he talk at all about his relationship with Robert Plant and John Paul Jones to these days, or is it kind of three different islands?
Well, you know, when they came to New York recently to promote their new movie, all three of them were hanging out together, and I spent some time, and they seemed to have a really good relationship, you know, just really easy and communicated really well. You know, the big problem these days is that, you know, Robert Plant and Jimmy Page get along really well, but they have one big difference of opinion, which is, you know, Jimmy would like to carry on with the band, and Robert is reluctant. But I think other than that, the relationship is really good. And I do have to say this is sort of the weird Dorian Gray thing is that Jimmy, you know, is probably in better physical and mental shape than he was when I first met him in 1993. He seems to pull off the good trick of somehow appearing younger and being more with it. I'm not sure why that is or how that is, but they all seem to be taking care of themselves.
I appreciate you taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Take care, Michael. It's interesting when I read that he thinks of, what he thinks people think of him. He said, many people think of me as just a riff guitarist, but I think of myself in broader terms. I sure do, after learning more about him, and he founded the band, and he really did have a vision going into it. Despite all the partying and all the excesses of the era, he really knew what he wanted right away.
Yeah, yeah. I think he said he wanted artistic control and a vice grip.
Yeah, there you go.
And that pretty much sums up Jimmy's approach altogether. Yeah, no, I mean, he talks about his days as a session musician where he, for 3 years, really learned the instrument inside out and how to play it in all sorts of different stylistically diverse ways. And then he went to the Yardbirds for a year or two and learned, you know, the craft of writing music and performing on stage. And also made all these observations about America when he was touring here with the Yardbirds, the rise of FM radio, how buying habits were changing from singles to albums, and thought, I could really put together a great band that could do well in this environment. And Led Zeppelin was the result of that. He went out and found the guys that he thought could make great music for FM radio. And then he went and recorded the first record, paying for the sessions with his own money, producing it himself. And then once it was finished, he took it to the record companies and told them, look, if you want this, you have to pay me this amount of money. Plus, we have to have total artistic control. And you can take that and that's just how they approach their music for the next 10, 15 years, is that they were really, really focused on having artistic control, doing their own thing, not having any interference, and having a clear vision of what they wanted to do. And a lot of that came down to Jimmy, who produced all the records.
You noted that the stereo mixes on the first two albums was very innovative, and you asked whether that was planned, and in his response, Jimmy Page said that he was very good at salvaging things that went wrong, and it felt like a metaphor for why he was so successful at everything he did. He really seemed to enjoy making lemonade out of lemons, to grab that cliche, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think whenever he had some sort of odd creative notion, whether it was putting in these strange sort of dissonant chords in the middle of the Immigrant Song, or creating Stairway to Heaven and making a song that started out slowly and accelerated in tempo to the end, and it came out well, you know, he's very, very proud of those kinds of moments. I think one thing that you have to say about him is, despite all of his talk about controlling everything and having these ideas, he's also really super generous towards the contributions of the other band members. He does say it was a group chemistry thing.
Oh, absolutely. And another thing that he did that maybe not a lot of people in his position do is, after the Yardbirds, I think he took on a job as a staff producer for an independent label.
Immediate Records.
Yeah. And he, that must have given him incredible production chops that served him well in the years to come.
Yeah. Well, I think it's hard to explain the impact of what Jimmy has done as a producer. But I'll give you a couple of examples. I mean, he produced people, a lot of people don't know this. The first couple of singles that Eric Clapton did with John Mayall and the Blues Breakers. And Eric Clapton's sound back then, pre-Cream, with the Blues Breakers, was really revolutionary. It was this huge, liquid, big-sounding guitar that nobody had ever really heard on record before. And it was essentially him putting a Les Paul through a relatively new Marshall amplifier. And Jimmy produced the first time that Eric Clapton put that combination together. And the engineers of that day wanted to say, you can't do that. That guitar is distorted. It doesn't sound good. You know, it didn't sound good to the technicians of that day. And Jimmy basically said, look, if you touch that, the faders or anything on that, I'm going to break your fingers. We're going to capture that sound. And to me, those singles like I'm Your Witch Doctor is the birth of the modern guitar sound, the modern guitar tone. You wouldn't have, you know, the Cream, or you wouldn't have Led Zeppelin, or you wouldn't have Jimi Hendrix without those groundbreaking sessions. So that's on the guitar front. Without getting too nerdy, he did the same thing for drums. And this is really the revolutionary thing about Jimmy Page's production, and something we really feel acutely today, is with Led Zeppelin, the way he recorded and mixed Bonham is he put the drums almost equal to the vocals. And that was a very, very new idea. I mean, you go back to the 60s, and a lot of the drums were mixed so there were a lot of great drummers, but they were mixed so they were more in the background. They were more of a timekeeper than they were had a starring role.
Mm-hmm.
And Led Zeppelin 1 is where you hear this drum sound being as equal of importance to the vocals or even to the guitars. And that's something that stayed with us ever since. I mean, whether you look at contemporary R&B and hip-hop or modern rock and country, that all comes back to Jimmy's vision of where he was placing and recording drums.
Bob in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome, Bob.
Hi, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's really exciting, but I'm curious to know about the guitar he played. When he played for Stairway to Heaven, he played a guitar that was 6 and 12 strings, I think, a double neck guitar. I wondered, did you talk to him about how he chose the guitar, and did he use it on any other songs, and if so, what are they?
Yeah, interestingly enough, he did not use that double neck guitar on the recording of Stairway to Heaven. He used a whole battery of guitars for Stairway, an acoustic harmony guitar. He used his Les Paul on the electric rhythms. He used a Fender 12 string on some of the parts, and he used a Telecaster for the guitar solo. But it was when he had to take this song to the stage and was trying to think, you know, how he could replicate all the textures that he had created in the studio on stage. He had remembered that Gibson had built this guitar that had two necks, that had the 12 string and the 6 string on it. And he thought, well, that's the only way I'm going to be able to recreate this particular song live. And he did not use the double neck that much in the studio, even on things like The Song Remains the Same, and some of the other more famous songs, Rain Song, that incorporated 12-string and 6-string. He tended to use separate instruments for those, but on stage, so he didn't have to switch back and forth, that's when he started using the double neck.
Thanks, Bob, for your call. We appreciate it. You know, speaking of his guitars, he was a loyal friend not only to his fellow musicians but also to his instruments.
Yes.
He could play any. He could have afforded. He can afford to buy any guitar in the world, and he still uses the same electric guitar from the mid '60s.
Yeah, no, that was the funny thing. Even in on the reunion shows, you know, he went back to using the Marshall that he toured with in the '70s, and his go-to guitar is still this Les Paul that he bought from Joe Walsh in 1969.
He calls them his old friends.
Yeah, absolutely. He said he had some comment. I don't know if I'm getting this right. I don't remember, but he referred to that Les Paul as his wife, and you know, and he said the great thing is that he doesn't have to pay it any alimony.
614-292-8513 is the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation. My guest is Brad Tolinsky, editor-in-chief of Guitar World magazine. We're talking about his new book, Light and Shade, Conversations with Jimmy Page. You can also post your question or comment on Facebook, as did Ben. He wrote, during your interview with Jimmy, did you uncover any details on an extended American tour? Does that make...
Yeah, well, you know, they get asked that all the time. And, you know, Jimmy says never say never, but I think that I don't think it's going to happen. Not because of Jimmy. I think he would love to put the band back together and play with them more. And I know he was quite disappointed after the O2 reunion show that they didn't do any other shows because they worked quite hard to put together that set. But Robert has a different view. I think there's two things in Robert's mind. One is that, you know, he doesn't mind revisiting the past, but I think the idea of living there for 2 years, you know, that it would take to put together an album or a tour doesn't appeal to him at this point in his life. But he's also said on several occasions that whenever they do anything with Led Zeppelin, the expectations are so great that it becomes, you know, a heavy thing rather than a fun thing. And to deal with people's expectations on who the band are, what they could do also for a couple years on end would be, I don't think the idea is appealing to him.
We will return to our conversation with Brad Tolinsky, author of Light and Shade, Conversations with Jimmy Page. After this, we'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the presidential race is neck and neck. What if the electoral vote ends in a tie? We'll go deep on what would happen next. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins this afternoon at 1. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides begins. And we'll have a discussion of the Clean Water Act celebrating its 40th anniversary. Also, a discussion of the looming threat of Hurricane Sandy to the East Coast and Ohio. Join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher from 11 till noon. And support for 89.7 comes from Columbus School for Girls, enrolling girls from preschool through grade 12. More information on CSG's academics, arts, athletics, and the all-girl learning environment at an upcoming admission open house, Sunday, November 4th from 1 to 3 p.m. at columbusschoolforgirls.org. Expect rain today, a high of 44, and then rain mixing with snow tonight, a low of 35 degrees. Snow Tuesday morning, rain in the afternoon, a high of 42. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. You can't talk about Led Zeppelin without mentioning Stairway to Heaven, of course. For many, the song that defined the band and a generation. Zeppelin founder and guitarist Jimmy Page co-wrote that song. He is the subject of a new book by Guitar World editor-in-chief Brad Tolinsky. The name of the book, Light and Shade, Conversations with Jimmy Page. Thanks again, Brad, for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. This is a lot of fun.
Jimmy Page, how did he feel about Stairway to Heaven?
I think Jimmy thought it was one of the band's greatest achievements. I mean, a lot of times bands want to, or a musician may want to distance himself from the song that they're most identified with because they're sick of it. But Jimmy was always particularly proud of Stairway to Heaven. That actually, Stairway represented a certain, I think, crossroads in a relationship that I had with Jimmy, because I was at a photo shoot with him, and he actually brought the guitar that he played Stairway to Heaven on with him, the acoustic guitar that he did the intro on. Mm-hmm. And I said, do you mind if I play, if I strum it, if I play it for a minute? And he's like, no, go ahead. But he was watching me, and the temptation just to have it for, to dine out on for the next 10 years, to actually play the opening of Stairway to Heaven on the Stairway to Heaven acoustic guitar was really tempting. But I think if I had done that, that probably would have ended the relationship.
Kind of like a sacrosanct.
Jimmy said that he knew it was a really, really good piece of music. And the first time the band played it, even before it was out on record, they got a standing ovation. And in the new movie, Celebration Day, I thought it was actually one of the highlights of the movie, because even though I know Robert isn't as big of a fan, they really performed it in this sort of super careful, respectful way, because I think they know what it means to, the fans in general, a lot of people out there.
He doesn't get tired of his music. And I think a big reason to me after reading the book was that they never think a song is finished. He compared music to painting, and how Picasso once said that a painting is never done. And I think that was during an interview you did with him and Jack White of the White Stripes.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting. They were devoted to improvisation. They liked to riff off their songs.
Right. Yeah. Well, sometimes Jimmy, people will criticize him as a guitarist, especially live, for being a little sloppy. Not as technically careful as some other guitar players. But the truth of that comes from that they would always see the music as an evolving thing. And improvisation was an important element to them to keeping these songs evolving and changing and keeping them exciting. And Jimmy says, when you get up on a tightrope, sometimes you walk and sometimes you fall off. But that's when the real creativity, that's when the really excitement happens, is when there's that tension, when you go off into places that you've never been before.
Which makes me feel like, as much as I love Led Zeppelin, I never saw them in concert, and it must have been amazing to see them like that, hear them.
Yeah, I was pretty young when I saw the band in their prime, but I saw the O2 show. I went out to London to see it, and it was fantastic. And then there's a lot of, these days, oh my God, on YouTube, so many bootlegs, and
true,
you can hear all the different performances from different eras, and you see them really sort of sparking off of each other, and see the special musical relationship that these guys had.
Speaking of bootlegs, that was sort of a shocking story about how all the tapes that he had from their sessions had been stolen at some point. Yeah.
I think there was a period in Jimmy's life where he was pretty loose with who came in and came out of the door of his house, and at one point somebody walked off with a lot of goodies, or maybe multiple people.
Mm-hmm.
These days he's very unhappy about that, because they do, they do emerge in many and different ways.
Right. It's amazing the relationship he had with Jeff Beck and Eric Clapton, and that they grew up just miles from each other. And
yeah,
you compared the odds of that to having Willie Mays, Mickey Mantle, and Hank Aaron in the same Little League. And they're still pretty much close.
Yeah, they are. Maybe more Jeff and Jimmy,
right,
who see each other on pretty regular occasion, than with Eric. But these guys were pioneers, and they were pushing each other. I mean, they would go to each other's shows, they would see each other play, they would see the development, and it would affect what each one of them would do. For example, Jimmy had one of the very first fuzz pedals that he used in his studio work.
Is that like a wah-wah, or what do you mean by fuzz pedal? I was wondering.
A fuzz pedal is something that just distorts the sound and literally makes the guitar sound a little fuzzier. Okay. And I can give you a good example of that. Do you know the Yardbird song Over Under Sideways Down? You hear the Jeff Beck's
right.
Sort of fuzzy,
yeah,
almost sitar-y.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Jimmy had one of those first first fuzz pedals, you know, before Jimi Hendrix, before anybody. And in fact, Jeff was in a Yardbird session one day, and he wanted a sound that would sound a little more sitar. And he remembered that Jimmy had this thing. So, you know, Jimmy lent him perhaps the only fuzz pedal in London so he could go and play something on a Yardbirds record. So they were all very close, and they developed together, and what they did rubbed off on each other in a profound way.
Very much a student of all stringed instruments. He started playing a sitar way before the Beatles did, started experimenting with it.
Yeah. Yeah. He is always a little sheepish about saying that he was playing the sitar long before George Harrison had picked it up.
Mm-hmm.
But it's true. But he also works it into his conversations, too. So I think he's also proud of the fact. But I think an important element to Zeppelin sound in general is that I don't know if they were the first band, but they were certainly one of the first. I mean, I suppose along with the Beatles, that worked, world music into their sound, made it an important component of what they did. You know, on the first record, you had Black Mountain Side, which almost sounds like a Indian reggae, and songs like Kashmir. And they were very serious about their world music influences. I mean, it was as important to Jimmy as the blues was to what he did, or rockabilly.
Rudy in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Rudy.
Oh, hi. I was curious, listening to you speak, about who really amazed Page, if he ever got in a conversation, of his contemporaries, say Hendrix, Clapton, Pete Townsend, and maybe more, you know, even later on, guitarist, and maybe even in different fields, say Pat Metheny or John Abercrombie. Did he ever talk other guitarists that knocked his socks off?
Yeah, I mean, he's pretty generous towards other musicians. In fact, he almost never says anything negative about, another musician. He considers anybody, in the music business to be artists and tends to look at what they do and the good in it. And he has a lot of people that he has respect for and loved. I mean, He, like the rest of us, really thought Jimi Hendrix was an amazing talent. And the funny thing is he never saw Jimmy play.
Huh.
He goes, I kept on wanting to go and see him play when he was in town. But, you know, when Jimmy was really sort of making his big statement early on in England, he was in America a lot with the Yardbirds, so he didn't get to see him play. And he kept on thinking, well, I'll go see him next time. And then, you know, unfortunately, there was no next time. But he admired Jimmy a lot. He thought Sid Barrett of the original Pink Floyd was a visionary. Spoke highly of Sid's work on the very first Pink Floyd record. Of course, he, you know, he, I don't think he thinks there's anybody better than Jeff Beck. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's just because they're friends. I mean, Jeff Beck is an incredible guitar player. But he also pretty regularly goes out and sees shows. I mean, he tries to stay up on current music. And, you know, he does like Jack White. I actually introduced those guys. And
you mean that interview you did with them? You set up that interview that way?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I saw the similarities in many things of what they were doing, and thought they would just you know, get on really well. And then that developed into, you know, that movie later, the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
But let's see. You know, like I know he likes Soundgarden. He saw them play recently and was really impressed in London, and Tool, a lot of other bands. He goes to shows quite a bit. When he came to New York a couple weeks ago, I actually took him to the Iridium to see Joe Walsh play, which is a small club. And him and Joe have a long relationship.
Yeah. All right. Ohio boy, got a connection there. All right. Well, thanks very much.
Thanks, Rudy. Mm-hmm. I was glad to read of his admiration for the original Fleetwood Mac with Peter Green.
Oh, yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. Albatross, I've loved it since the first time I heard it. I like the Killin' House and post-Peter Green, too. But he said something like, to tell you the truth, and that he loved them. So, of course, it's they're a shadow of what they were back then.
Yeah, well, Peter Green was really special mm-hmm. back in those early days, and he's had his battles with mental illness, mm-hmm. I know, which obviously stopped him from developing the way he could. But when you talk to Clapton or any of those guys, even B.B. King, will talk about Peter Green with admiration. Great guitar, great sort of lost guitar player.
Email from Terry asks, how does the author feel about Page's participation in the DVD It Might Get Loud? I loved the juxtaposition of the artist's perspectives.
How did the other band...
How did you feel about...
Oh, how did I feel about it?
Page's participation in It Might Get Loud.
Well, I think Jimmy... you know, I like it any time that Jimmy actually gets out there. I think he should be more active. I think he should be creating music, you know. So anytime I see Jimmy, you know, participating in any sort of artistic endeavor, I'm always happy about that. I thought the movie was pretty good. I suppose without sounding territorial, I know what it takes to actually get Jimmy to open up, which is it takes a lot of time and sort of a lot of work. And I know that that movie was made in a relatively short period of time. And it's probably the most open most of the public has seen Jimmy. But I still felt that given more time, they could have gone a little deeper with him. I love the scene in the at Headley Grange, you know, in the main room where they were talking about recording the drums. And, you know, I thought it was good.
Email from Michael. He asks, is Jimmy more proud of his writing or playing?
I think he sees it as all part and parcel of one thing. Here's the thing. And again, it's sort of funny because I think the critical community has, even to this day, doesn't exactly know why they like Led Zeppelin. I mean, they'll go on for hours and hours about why they like the Stones or the Beatles or Dylan. But I very rarely read anything truly insightful about why, what makes Led Zeppelin great. And I think some of it is the complexity of who Jimmy Page and the other guys are. I mean, for Jimmy, the artistic process is, it's the guitar, it's using the studio as an instrument, but it's all these other things. When you talk to him, he brings in, he's very knowledgeable in art history. He talks about music in terms of architecture. He's a big fan of architecture. He's got this other metaphysical bent that's a lot of people have made a lot out of it. So I think you can't think of this guy as just a guy with a guitar. I think he's a genuine artist, like you would think of Miles Davis or, Duke Ellington, or, you know, he's sort of on that level of, okay, he's a musician, but there's so much more to the person than that, just that.
Phil in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about Stairway to Heaven, and I can take my answer offline.
Okay.
There's a viral video out on the web that shows sort of the origins of many of their songs, apparently.
Yes.
And I just listened to one of them, and I am shocked that that essentially Stairway to Heaven seems not to be their own music, at least the guitar line. Anyway, that was my question. Is your perspective on that? You might have touched on it earlier, so I'm sorry. I just got in here late. So
we
thank
did
you
not.
So much.
Thank you, Phil.
Thanks.
We have about a minute and a half left. Brad Tolinsky. So.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I know what he's referring to. There's a song by Spirit that has certain elements of Stairway to Heaven in it that Jimmy may or may not have heard. He's never commented on that in particular. But I think... I think that's been exaggerated. I mean, there's like a little bit in that in that chord progression that's on that one Spirit song. But it's really funny. I interviewed Eric Clapton, several years ago, and we talked a little bit about Led Zeppelin, and he said, "Well, I'm not a huge fan of those guys, but." I wrote this song called Let It Grow, and all of a sudden somebody pointed out to me that it was the exact same chord progression as Stairway to Heaven.
Yep.
So he said, I guess you can't escape it.
Yep,
you know?
Yep, that's a great song, too. I love that song. So there you go. Brad Tolinsky, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. This was great.
Brad Tolinsky, editor-in-chief of Guitar World magazine and author of Light and Shade, Conversations with Jimmy Page. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.